Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bull to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke. Don't do
if I had $1 million.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Allen. Andrew on the board. Got S&P futures down 5. NASDAQ futures down 42. This is after yesterday. We bounced back from the down day on Monday. So we were down like 21 or 22 on Monday. We're up 24 yesterday. Same thing in the NASDAQ. So kind of a flipperoo. So we're kind of right back to where we were Friday night. Whatever that tells you, I don't know. But individual stuff flying back and forth. Now tonight, I think NVIDIA earnings are tonight. They're obviously the big deal. The straddle is not that expensive. So maybe people are thinking it's not going to be a big deal, but boy, I don't know. It usually is. I think the, I think it's going to make some kind of movement. But it was up. It's been up a bunch this week, but still, it's kind of been in a holding pattern. A lot of the other stocks have gone up. It kind of is doing the different. Micron goes one way, and Microsoft and Nvidia kind of go the other way. It's been really bizarre lately. But I've got these guys at pretty high revenue per share. So you know, they need to continue to do better to grow into their numbers, in one man's opinion. But anyway, do we have Professor Kevin? We do not.
Looks like we got him on the call here.
Maybe he's... Kevin, unmute thyself.
He's unmuted. He might just need a second.
All right, well, hopefully he's not being attacked by, like, a rat or something. The, speaking of which, We got some rats in our alley. Is there somebody to call in the city so they get rid of the rats, or what's that all about?
Isn't that like I know, I'm thinking of the Target rat sign.
You know. God, you know, we got those. They're hanging around under the sign. You know, it's not a good thing. You would think that in a neighborhood where the houses are that expensive, they would do a little something. So we have Kevin, but he's got himself muted. I wanted to ask him about if he watched any of the Little League World Series. I watched Alabama play Pennsylvania, and on the Alabama team, they have this young lady who is spectacular. She's like their best pitcher and their shortstop. She's like the Ohtani of ladies. And there's been 26 or 27 women that have played in the Little League World Series. I did not know that. There's two this year. She's the son of a major league player. I think her name is Rambus. Why don't you look that up if you got a second, Andrew? I mean, I think... But they won in extra innings. I don't know how far they're going to go, but it was this girl pitching, or this person pitching, and I'm going, wait a minute. Even with the head on, that's not a guy, that's a girl. And she's, you know, winging the thing in there. And the guy she was pitching against was like one of the hardest throwers in the thing, and she couldn't throw as hard as he did, but she wasn't that far off, and she had better curveball and stuff than he did. There's strict limits on pitches and stuff now for these people, so you end up getting the best pitchers sometimes pitching later in the game instead of starting, which is a little strange. But the Little League World Series, I think it's a lot of fun to watch. If anybody else, still no Kevin, eh? Well, let's dig into some of the news of today. On the individual stocks moving, I've got really nothing going anywhere here. I've got in the Dow, we had some big movements yesterday. Caterpillar was up another 370. These guys are really something. They got into this AI with one branch that they bought. It goes up and down now like a AI stock, even though I got to believe 90% of their business is still the core business, but still it's up and down. Now today we've got Micron is down $3, but it's been up and down all over the place. Just to give everybody a taste here of Micron, we get a new chart. Stock has been, I've got the, we'll get the one-year graph. one-year chart, sorry. We started the year, at last 827, 2025 stock was 117. Ran up to, let's see, 1133 in June. Went down to 735 or so in July, and now it's 930. And that's quite really something. And I, you know, everybody knows I don't give, I certainly don't give advice on individual stocks, but I do point out once in a while some of these numbers that over time I've looked at, and nobody has to agree with me, but I think the revenue per share number is some kind of a bigger number sometimes to evaluate than earnings, because earnings, if you're building a lot of stuff like AI and stuff, your earnings could be down because you're spending a lot of money. But the revenue per share really is something you can't hide from, and you have to ask yourself all the time, well, can somebody really grow into this number? Now, the revenue per share is $80, so we're talking a very mature company, which is trading, you know, roughly 12-13 times revenue. That's a lot. Some of the companies, like Palantir, is like 40-something times revenue. NVIDIA is pretty high, too. Not 40-something, but they're pretty high, too. See, when you say they grew, you know, 20% last year or 25% last year, I mean, that's terrific on a percentage basis. But you have to ask yourself, I mean, at any day, again, this is maybe old-fashioned valuation. Stocks can trade anywhere, obviously, because people have an idea of the future. And that's the fun of it, and that's the beauty of it, and that's the fun about being involved in the market is trying to pick companies you think are going to do well and so forth, or sell against companies you don't. But not many people do that. The idea that at some point you expect every company is going to sort of mature at some point. It could be 6 months, it could be 60 years, but someplace somewhere. The place is going to land. The company is going to land into a spot where they've got their niche, and they're making a bunch of money, and they're sending you some of it. And they're not just all paying themselves bonuses and all the other stuff. So you have to ask yourself, is the company ready to do that? I mean, at some point, is Micron going to be making earnings per share is $45? So they're 20. When are they? They're almost 20 times earnings, which is a lot. So at some point, you would think they would be making $60 on a stock that's $1,000 or close to it and sending you a check for $15. If you don't think that's ever going to happen, it's up to you to essentially get out by yourself. In other words, if they're not going to send you a check ever, like, you know, Musk is never, if you bought 1,000 shares of Micron at $100, God love you if you did, and now it's up to $1,000 almost, somewhere along the line, it's up to you to take your own profits. I mean, if it gets to 500, maybe you sell 500 shares. If it gets to 750, and now it's at 931, it was over 1,000. Somewhere, someplace, you need to lighten up. When I say need to, I mean, you may not need to, it may go to 2,000, but When you bought 1,000 shares of it at $100, well, that's a lot of money. That's $100,000. So for you to do that, you must have one hell of a portfolio if one investment is $100,000 out of the gate. So if you're going to be a diversified investment, now people want to be diversified, pretty much use an ETF or something like that. That's what we use a lot for our protected index program, hence the name index. But we also, have a lot of concentration issues, so we use the same logic. But what I'm saying is, if $100,000 was, let's say you had a million-dollar account or $2 million account, and you said, well, I'm going to pick 20 stocks that I'm really going to like, and I'm going to try and diversify, and I'm going to put $100,000 in 20 different stocks. And lo and behold, 3 years later, you got a few that might be actually down, a few that are flat, and several or many, most of them are up. Then you got one or two that are like really way up. And when they say rebalancing, you need to take a look at it and at least say, okay, I now have the same 20 stocks, but no, one of them, you know, is $100,000 or is $1 million in that $100,000. Well, that's pretty damn good, right? that's the idea, but now you're not balanced. You would not. And then one of the hardest things to do is to say, I really like these same 20 stocks. I'm going to lighten up a little on the big winner, and maybe, you know, if I really like the ones that haven't done as well, I'm going to put a little more in there. That's called rebalancing. It's very difficult to do. And that's why you see people, that's why I get portfolios from people that have, you know, 3-4 stocks left, because they've sold all the, essentially the losers, and put money back in the winners. Well, that's fine as long as something remains to be a winner. And but if you, I mean, you wouldn't start out if somebody gave you, you know, now like $5 million, say you're up that much over the last over many years, you probably wouldn't, if you still have the same 20 stacks, you'd be putting, you know, 250 grand in a stack. And now all of a sudden you've got a million and one. Now, if you like it that well, then that's okay. Or you could come to somebody who knows what he's doing in terms of options, somebody like maybe me, and say, okay, I really want all this Micron stock, but I want to cut some of the risk out of it. If it goes back to $117, which I don't think it's going to, but if it does, I don't want to give all that money back. Is there something we can do? Is there, you know, can we get some put insurance? Can we sell calls, which doesn't really give you insurance? Is there something we can do? And then if you find somebody that knows that stuff, you can then have the conversation. Now, it's going to cost you because, you know, it's like buying any kind of insurance. But you can say, I really want to keep my Micron, but guess what? I don't really want $1 million worth of risk in any one stack in my now $3 or $4 million portfolio. So you can have these conversations like very rationally. It's not, oh, man, I like Micron. I'm never going to sell it. Well, okay, that's I'm not going to sell it at any price. Okay, tomorrow it's $1,500. I still can't sell it. I mean, you can think that way, but that's what, you know, lately it hasn't gotten people in trouble, but it has in the past, and may again. We still got no Kevin. I wonder if he's okay.
Well, you got me. You guys kicked me out of Zoom and restarted it.
Oh, well, Andrew said that you weren't muted, but you weren't there. Anyway, welcome. Sorry. Welcome. How are you?
I was there, and then Zoom terminated, and there I was back. But, you know, I was listening to this very, very riveting verbal math lesson.
Well, it's not... It, you're just jealous, and so am I, that we don't have 1,000 shares of bike ride. What can I tell you?
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
What do you think the French language issue is with the United States and Canada?
From what I read, that they wanted something about didn't want there to be an official language or a double language. I'm not really sure. No, I didn't focus on that one.
Where
I focused on the other one.
Did you read that?
It's been a lot of spots.
A lot of spots? Like what?
I watched probably 15 different YouTubes yesterday, knowing you'd be on me about this, and they said it was part of they don't want the French language to be pushed any further. The people in Quebec are all pissed off about it. Now, maybe the people in Quebec
don't want it to be pushed any further. Here's what the issue is, that the Canadians have some very, very specific non-tariff trade barriers. First of all, how long do you think this has been a bone of contention in the U.S. and Canada trade negotiations? How long do you think it's been?
No idea.
Since NAFTA.
Okay.
Okay. So this is not some new thing that Trump did. It's since NAFTA. And so they have product packaging rules in Quebec that require you to primarily label everything in French. So that means, you know, for sending to that one province, you have to change how you do this. Now, that might be smart business for some companies anyway, and it might not be that big a compliance burden for some companies, but for any small company that has to do that, that's a much, you know, it's the same expense that they have to deal with that the large companies have to deal with. It's just harder for them to absorb. They also have digital streaming quotas, so that means that anybody like Netflix or Spotify or anybody has to prioritize and promote French language content. So they're telling us, you know, they want to tell us what we have to highlight for them. And so these are the issues. And it's not that isn't solvable, but who do you think walked away from the negotiations?
I think they walked away, and I when I heard the reasons were, who knows, there's a bunch of people with the reasons, but the idea of this whole, when you start the whole mess by insulting the shit out of people.
Like what insult?
Well, let's see. Elizabeth Warren had Lutnick on, and she was quizzing him yesterday, and she said, why did you say the people of Canada suck? Because he did 2 days ago.
He said,
well, they've been treating us really bad. She goes, but why are you insulting people? Why do you say stuff like that? And he's like, why can't I say stuff like that? This is in the Senate. I mean, it's insanity. I listened to I will say this, and Kevin is absolutely correct. When you start talking about a tariff deal, it is so incredibly complicated. And then when you start talking about individual, actually, Kevin, when they did this in Trump's first term, I made the mistake, and you were on, I think. I made the mistake of actually digging through the tariffs. Good Lord, don't ever do that. It's how many hundred pages, Kevin? It's unreal. And there's stuff, there'll be a... I didn't realize that there were so many different kinds. I landed on the cottage cheese page. You know, there's whole, large curd, whole milk cottage cheese. There's small curd. There had to be 15 different kinds of cottage cheese. And people are all over this on both sides. I mean, it's such a technical thing, but I listened to Ron Insano, who actually spoke with us at a seminar in 1991. He's a good guy. He was out with two other people, and he's never been all that political one way or the other. And they asked him, and he goes, I just don't understand the purpose of any of this. He goes, in Trump's first term, he renegotiated essentially the NAFTA deal, and because he said it was a bad deal, and he renegotiated it, and they were having all these quotes. They now made, and Ron Insano said there probably was some bad stuff in there that Trump noticed, but he redid the whole thing and announced that it was the greatest deal ever. And here it is, you know, 4 years later, 5 years later.
It's a little more than that, but go on.
6 years, and now the whole thing is a piece of crap, and he's got to insult everybody and all this other kind of... What is the point? I mean,
What do you suppose the Trump administration's biggest problem with Canada is?
I have no idea. Well, they'd want them to make a 51st state out of them.
Familiar with China's transshipment network?
Okay,
Are you familiar with it?
Yes. I also know that this is... That's one of the reason why, according to like three or four people, and you're going to say they're the wrong people, the reason why the deal went down is we wanted approval of any other trade deal they made with anybody else.
Yeah, that's been in the last two trade agreements.
Okay, not
approval of any other. It's approval of any trade deal that would be better than this one. So they can't turn around and say we have a most favored.
How do you know that's what it says?
I don't know. Maybe I read it.
Okay, well, the people were reading it to me on YouTube and on the air. It basically said this was that's why the thing was absolutely a done deal on like Friday and fell apart on a Saturday. It was evidently that clause and another clause that they had extended all along. People were assuming evidently, again, this is a few people, they're showing the different clauses. They were assuming that the reduction in tariffs on automobiles also applied to medium heavy duty trucks. And it turns out that doesn't apply. And that's when Canada said no. Those two things, according to these two people, were the deal breakers. Because it happened pretty fast, right? When was it a done deal? On, like, Thursday? It was canceled on Saturday? I mean, everybody was expecting a huge announcement to the positive on Saturday. Or was it Friday? Whatever. And then all of a sudden, it wasn't.
It didn't happen. So who is one of the biggest violators of, for Chinese transshipments?
According to who? You read one group of people, and I read another. I mean, according to who?
You're very dismissive of anything. You say if it comes out of the Trump administration, it's wrong. The Trump administration published a 25-page report on transshipments, and it documents everything. So it's not just here's what we think. It's it has receipts in it.
How do you determine what to believe or not believe out of a group that lies a lot?
Who am I supposed to believe then, Carney?
I'm not sure who you believe today, but you can't just pick a side.
Carney ran the Bank of England when when a number of large British banks were laundering Iranian money to get around sanctions.
Okay, we have people who are laundering.
So that's who I'm going to believe instead.
Okay, well, we have people here that are laundering Iranian money.
But we may, but that doesn't make Carney okay.
Okay, so for the rest of his life, no matter what new job he gets, he's painted with this brush, like Biden or like Obama. I mean, for God's sake, I mean the guy has a new job now.
Well, yeah.
Iranian money has been going all over. Do you think there's no laundering of Russian money here? How does Russia manage to get the money that we're not supposed to?
Don't give me that. Your mother wouldn't have said, but other people do it too.
No, but I'm saying, but that's what. You're the fourth conservative person this week that said because of he was a Bank of England guy, everything he does now you can't believe. I mean, what does that even mean?
Well, that's not what I'm saying. Is I'm saying that the guy has always had an alternate agenda because, he was either stupid that this was going on under his watch and he had no idea, or he looked the other way and let it happen. But either way, he did. And I got a kick out of you guys on Monday. You were so impressed. He's no lightweight. He ran the Bank of England. Yeah, let's make Jerome Powell prime minister someplace too. Because he ran the federal reserve.
Okay, so he's less qualified for the job than Trump.
I don't know what qualified means.
Yeah, I don't either anymore.
is that what I just said?
Well, because you made it sound like he shouldn't be there.
Paraphrasing what I didn't say.
Well, it's not what you say, Kevin. It's what people hear.
No, it's what I say. And if people hear it wrong, that's their problem, not mine.
Okay, I mean, no.
Because I don't mumble.
So what... What exactly? What am I supposed to think of Carney now? Everything he says for the rest of his life, he's a chump.
No, I don't. Did I say he's a chump?
You're saying he looked the other way and laundered.
Either or, but I tend to think he looked the other way.
Okay.
What else do you know about Carney?
I don't. All I know is he's the prime minister right now.
Yeah. What else? You don't know anything else about his background?
He didn't hang around with Epstein. I mean, where are we going to go with this?
Good job on that one. Yeah, that's
a
good argument.
But what does it even matter? What does it matter what somebody's? We're stuck with the guy now, and we're stuck with Trump.
If for WEF he helped craft the Great Reset, is that something that you're fond of? Because that's behavioral modification of individuals. That's it's a big spend on the green movement, ESG integration.
Where are you going with this? So every insult.
No, what I'm saying is every time you talk about it, it's all Trump's fault. And it isn't necessarily all Trump's fault.
I didn't say it was.
This guy is completely in opposition to Trump. And his desire to walk away, there's a good chance that that's to try and create some chaos and disrupt the midterm elections, and we just love it when foreign leaders do that.
Kevin, the second person on this trio of people that was there with Ron and Sana, they asked him what his opinions were, and he said something to the effect that the American people, especially supporters of the current administration, have no idea and are blind to the fact of how much the insults in the 51st states and all the other kind of crap that Trump says about people, how much that hurts. The people here that like the guy think that's just his New York way of doing things and everybody else should be okay with it. They're not. They're not okay with it. Because,
well, you know, there's also some people who think that Carney has been foolish. So we can take Kellyanne Shaw, who is from the Aiken Group, a lobbying group, but she's on she's Canadian, who is on CBC, which is decidedly not a Trump favored network, the Canadian Broadcasting Company. And she says that Washington was prepared to ease tariffs on steel, aluminum, lumber, autos, and that it was foolish to walk away from that. They should have continued to negotiate. And she said Canada's going to pay a terrible price on that.
Okay. Well,
now, that's not me. That's somebody who is in you know, operates in that world, speaking to Canadians, a Canadian speaking to Canadians on the Canadian Broadcasting Company.
Okay, so but why?
But don't go with this everybody thing.
So, okay, there probably are a few Canadians that don't mind being the 51st state. Where are they? I mean, you don't. This idea of starting every negotiation with an insult, to me, is it's not my way.
Does every negotiation start with an insult?
With this guy? Absolutely.
Okay, tell me about it.
Oh, Greenland?
Yeah.
Okay, that didn't start with, we're taking it over.
Was that an insult, or was
What is it? Okay. Well, Kevin, you would never treat anybody like that. Why do you defend this guy from doing it?
Am I defending him, or am I just asking you a question? I want you to
the
explain.
The question is, he has insulted the Canadians now for 2 years. And then it gets into a negotiation. Yes, I think the Canadians, in a lot of ways, are sorry this thing fell apart. And so are we. And so are we.
Yeah.
The point is, why can't...
What I'm arguing with you about is your inclination, and this is true of anything as it relates to Trump. You want to jump to, you want to jump to the conclusion that it's his fault, only his fault, nobody else is at fault, nobody else plays in this game. And and then you complain that someone tries to that people like me sometimes will say, well, let me explain to you what they're trying to accomplish, and you are mystified that anybody would have to explain that. Would anybody go explain it? And that's because I send you stuff that explains it, and you won't read it.
Read
the national security strategy, the counterterrorism strategy, the financial stability oversight report. You won't read the science and research new position of the White House. Won't read it, and then you're mad that someone tries to explain it.
No, I'm not mad at all. My point is I'm trying to do is watch what's going on because that's what I do for people.
Can you watch?
I'm watching what's going on. I'm watching that.
They give you.
Here's what. Okay, you can give me all you want. I know that the man. I look at the guy. 6 months ago or 8 months ago, he came. We bombed the shit out of Iran, and he said, if they can't have a nuclear bomb, we're good for like another 6 years. Here we are 6 months later in a quagmire. Obviously, he was wrong the first time, or he's wrong this time. Now, whether there's some piece of paper somewhere that explains this, or there's some Solomon behind him, which I don't see, the same thing with this Canadian thing. It was done 6 years ago. Now, all of a sudden, the Canadians are the worst people on earth. Well, what's changed? I mean, is there no question that they're fighting for their people the same as we're fighting ours? I mean,
I have no doubt about that.
Right now,
fight for the people, then don't walk away.
We have all kinds
of. That is a total bullshit position. I'm fighting for my people, so I'm walking away.
Okay, no. From what I heard, the thing that caused it to walk away was the idea that we had to approve any of their other stuff. And their opinion of Trump is not very good. And they've spent an entire year trying to find other ways to do business other than with us. And there's no doubt about that.
From what you heard from where?
What do you mean? All the stuff with the pipeline to Vancouver and everything else. There was three or four of their guys on, including Carney, yesterday saying, we have decided that we can no longer count on America for this favored spot. And we are making sure that we have other places to go for our goods. So then we, from what I read, lob one in there. By the way, we have to approve any of these new deals. And they say no. I mean, how it got here, I have no idea,
that's
Kevin.
That's in USMCA, too.
What?
That's in USMCA already. It's the same provision.
You're total denying that there's any connection between our negotiating tactics and Trump's constant 51st state, we need to take them over. What do you say? We're going to invade one time? Didn't he have ships there? We were going to take over the Great Lakes, the thing with the bridge. The Canadians they're not that thin skinned or thick skinned. This is anything they see in there that looks for any time.
They are.
Okay. You're saying that none of that has anything to do with this. Whatever. Somehow the thing fell apart.
What I'm telling you is that they should put on their big boy pants.
Okay, and just agree with us. What's even simple stuff?
Did I say that, Tom? Did I say that?
Even simple stuff.
No, well, no, go back to that. Did I say they should just agree with
that? That's what people heard.
If you're going to paraphrase me, you should do it accurately.
Okay. You and I have this constant thing that it's not what you say, it's what people hear.
Bullshit. It's what I say.
Okay.
Because I'm only responsible for what I say. If you want to hear it wrong, that's on you.
Okay. Fair enough. Even a simple stuff, we're having tariffs on cars. Where's the Canadian car? Is there one?
I don't know. Where's the Japanese car?
I mean, when you say there's a tariff on a car, most people are going to hear, well, gee, this is 30 years ago. A Mercedes shows up at the port, and we put a $10,000 tariff on a Mercedes. When you've got Chevrolets that people here buy, assembled in Toronto, which, by the way, the transmission, the motor, and God knows a lot of other stuff are made here in the first place. Now, how's this even going to work, Kevin? When the transmission goes to Toronto, they're going to put a 50% tariff on it. And when the truck comes back here, what's this truck going to cost?
I don't know. Haven't done the math.
Well, I mean, there is no Canadian car, is there? I mean, maybe there's. Are there Toyotas assembled up there? Maybe there are. That part I would get, I guess. What does that mean by assembled? I mean, the motor still comes from Japan. This is so complicated, and when we lob this stuff out, people pick up sides without even knowing. I don't even know how the hell this is going to work. It's not like there's a, you know, there's a Canadian. What do you want to call it? Whatever you want to name their car that they're selling down here. It's not like it's a Toyota made in Japan. And they sell some of those here, which complicate or make it here too. This is so complicated. It's not about. So, if you just look at it, is there going to be a 50% tariff on the final value of an F-150 assembled in Toronto? I mean, now the thing's going to be $140,000.
So you're asking that question. Do you know the answer?
I don't.
Oh, okay. Well, then go ahead.
I'm saying, but I'm saying the point is when you say
that's what you don't know. I love it.
These are. Do you? But I'm saying there is no Canadian.
I'm not criticizing it either.
Do you know that there's a what when you say on Canadian cars there isn't a Canadian car? Do you know
what?
Is there a Canuck?
Canadian made? Could it be considered Canadian assembled? I don't know, so I'm not criticizing it. I'm not even making an issue of it. You don't know. You're just making an issue of it.
I'm saying that people love to tell people these stories and they lob these definitions out there, knowing full well that people know what the hell they're talking about. Which I think
people?
Is very. I try not to do that, by the way.
Who are people?
How many people in the administration in the last 2 days said we're going to put a 50% tariff on Canadian cars?
Well,
anybody listen to?
Because you're the one listening. Who? How many people?
Kevin, I listen.
And which ones are there?
You're saying there's not a 50%. Look up
no,
today.
I'm
What's
not
the
saying that? There you go, saying what I did not say. I'm just asking you who.
Who? You sound like a fucking owl, for God's sake. I mean, I listen to 15 people here. I don't keep a whole list so I can read them off to you in the morning.
Well, if you're going to cite sources, then they probably
okay.
ought to have names.
Andrew, Google, what is the new tariff on Canadian automobiles? It's going to come up 50%.
Okay.
Now, you're saying it's
I'm
not.
That.
All right,
but
so, and my point was, what is that? What does that mean?
People as a source, people's not a very good source. Tom.
Okay, my question is, what does that even mean? There isn't the Canadian car.
Yeah, it's 50%.
Yeah. All right, so now I'm quoting Andrew.
Okay.
All right, now am I asking you, what does that even mean?
I don't know, because I'm not the one bitching about it.
Well,
so I haven't looked at it. I'm not complaining one way or
all right,
the other.
So if,
I don't know.
All right, if you're going to go out tomorrow and buy a new F-150... Are you going to be paying 50% more? Is the question. I hope not. I can't afford one now. I mean, last thing I want to do is pay $150,000 for one. I mean, what we're whipping this stuff around and they don't give anybody any definitions, which I think is a little bit weird.
Okay.
I mean, what does it mean to the price of a house here? I mean, the Canadian lumber. From what I understand, we had a two part. And a lot of this stuff, and again, this is what's so complicated. I don't want to go through on the show because I did this 4 years ago or 5 years ago, and Trump did it the first time 6 years ago. As you go through, we have on the dairy stuff, it's a two-tone system, it's a two-level system. We get to export into Canada certain amount of dairy at a certain tariff rate. This is what Canada is doing to us. So it's not like it's just, I agree with you, it's not just us doing it to them. But there's a certain amount Canada is very concerned about their dairy farmers. We basically can't put them all out of business, all right? And, you know, I guess I understand that. So at a certain level, we can bring in cottage cheese and sour cream and whatever the hell it all else is. It's very complicated. Once it reaches a certain level, the tariffs jump up. And then to do more than that, where they think we're going to put their people out of business, which, by the way, is the exact same deal we have with Canadian lumber. We import a certain amount at a certain amount of tariff, but if it reaches a price where we think we're going to totally screw the American growers because evidently they're higher cost or whatever, then it jumps up. We do the same thing with sugar. It's like, I think I know this one, I think it's like 4 cents a pound is the tariff coming in, and then the Minnesota people that do the, what do they do up there, Kevin, the sugar beets and the sugar cane down south. But once it reaches a certain level, then it jumps to 12 cents because then we think we're putting people under. So a lot of this stuff has been around and is, quote, legit. The Japanese do the same thing with rice. For a certain level, they want to be able to have enough rice growers in their place that if the world ever goes crazy or China ever encircles them, they have enough to feed themselves. So there's a certain level that we can, because we produce rice way cheaper than they do in Japan. So we can put them all out of business tomorrow if we wanted to. But they don't want that. So for a certain level, we get to export rice in Japan at kind of a lower tariff, and it gets to a certain number, it jumps way up. So this stuff is amazingly complicated. I mean,
it is. And, you know, for cars under USMCA, the only thing that was tariffed as it came out of Canada or anywhere else was the value added.
Well, you would hope so. You would hope so, yeah.
So it was just the value added. I don't think there is any clarity yet on what that means for this week's 50% tariff. So I guess I have to wait and see on that and see what I think.
Yeah,
about.
I mean, it might turn out to be a little bit of nothing, right?
Well, it might. Yeah. So, you know, and so I said I'm not willing to fly off the handle until I know something about it.
Well, I'm not. We don't need another crisis, and we don't need one with Canada while we're facing all these other guys that actually don't like us. So I'd like to see this settle down as quick as possible. And if it's on Carney's end, then he can make one final concession. I hope he does it. You know, if it's on our end, I hope we do it. Whatever. I was hoping this thing was over Saturday, to be honest with you. I thought it was. It would be something we weren't even talking about.
We'd be talking too, but you know, are there ulterior motives for Carney?
Or us.
He's got elections coming up, too, so...
I get that part. I mean...
So, you know, is being anti-Trump a popular thing for him? And so is this a stunt on his part? And I hesitate to use the word, but it was the first one that came to mind. Is this a stunt on his part to try and shore up his voting base?
Well, instead of coming up rationally like you are, by the way, and talking about how this thing could still be done and how maybe those guys, what do? We come out the next day and say we're going to rename Lake Ontario Lake America.
Yeah, okay, it's bluster. I get it, and I guess that you don't like it. I don't care.
You don't, but you're making the assumption that Canadians shouldn't care.
Well, they can care if they want to.
Okay, well, obviously they do. And it's unnecessary.
I would agree with that. I would agree with that. As Lou says, you know, Trump, having Trump is like having your his worst client.
Yeah.
Even when he's right, he's a difficult client. No, I get that. I wish they would let Vance and Rubio do all the talking.
Yeah, I do too. Hey, first part of the show, I don't know if you were totally muted. Did you see the girl pitching from Alabama in the World Series? There's been, I didn't, you know,
Little League World Series.
Call me a dummy. I didn't. There's been 26 girls that have played in the Little League World Series.
Yeah, okay, doesn't surprise me.
But when there's two this year, and one of them is she's a phenom. She's a her name. I think his name. Her name is Andrew. Look this up. Is it Rambus or is she, her dad was a major league player somewhere? She's like the Ohtani of Little League baseball. She's the pitcher and plays shortstop. She was pitching the other night. I'm going, wait a minute, that's not a guy. I had no idea that girls played in the Little League World Series. Talk about being a dummy, Spacks and Jacks.
Yeah, no, they play in Little League. Now, by then, most girls are on the softball circuit instead. They're playing fast pitch softball. But you can play, and you know it's not the same as when they're adults. They're at age 12, girls are more physically advanced than boys in a lot of cases. So
well, the guy was firing at 70 miles an hour.
That's going to change over the next few years, yeah. But in her case now, that's fantastic. Good for her.
Is there any
her name is Kinley Rasmus.
Rasmus,
I'm saying that right.
There you go. And her dad played I think he played some major league baseball someplace. But I guess the question for you, Kevin, where does she go after Little League? Could she play Pony League, or do places even have Pony League anymore?
I'm sure she can continue playing, but at some point she's going to shift to softball. For no other reason, that's where college scholarships are.
Well, the guy, I mean, this is weird. If you and I were watching it together, we would have been debating this one. The guy she's pitching against on the Pennsylvania team has allegedly one of the best fastballs. He's like 70 miles an hour, right? Which coming from that distance is pretty quick. And he's got this guy up there, and the guy keeps fouling him off. And these guys have real tough pinch counts, I think. And he keeps looking to the dugout, and the manager kept saying, no, you can't throw a curveball. You got to keep throwing a fastball. The kid was all pissed off. Well, they ended up losing an extra inning. I turned on the Cubs, but they went to extra innings with the Alabama team where the girl was pitching. But she didn't throw it as hard as he did, but, boy, she had some good – you know, she had some breaking balls that were pretty good, and the other kid didn't. Every time he threw something, it went in the dirt. But she, and they said when she doesn't pitch, she goes and plays shortstop or something, and she's like their best hitter. I mean, I was so proud looking at her. God, that's great. I mean, I just wonder. There's after that though. You're right. It's softball, and she could probably play on a Pony League team somewhere. But why would she? You know, type of thing.
Well, yeah, at some point you got to get yourself in line because free college is nothing to sneeze at. So,
oh yeah, what the? I just wondered. There is no anywhere, even in California, there's no like hardball baseball for girls that are like 14 or 15. Is there? There might be someplace.
I think all the leagues allow girls to play. You know, pretty much across the board, it just becomes, as you know, the older they get, it becomes less feasible for most.
Well, is anybody even, I use the term Pony League to people. Kevin, nobody knows the hell I'm talking about anymore. Pony League was a jump between Little League and regulation. Wasn't the bases were 75 instead of Little League 60, Major League's 90, and I think they were 75, right? The pitcher's mound was maybe, what, 53 or something? 54? And it was a year or two before you graduated to, like, high school and stuff is all major league size. And, for kids that are 13, it's pretty hard to pitch 60 feet. That happened to me. I was pretty, I was a good pitcher in Little League. And the next year we went right to Babe Ruth. We didn't have Pony League. And, boy, I'm playing against 15, 16 years old. I couldn't throw those guys out from 60 feet.
And you're playing on a full-size baseball field. Yeah, The Pony League was the in-between stop for 2 years.
I wonder, is that even, the people even do that?
I don't know if it's a thing or not. My kids are way beyond that age group, so I don't know what they have.
Did your daughter ever play, did she ever play softball?
No.
I mean, I don't think
she played soccer for a little while, but Amy wasn't athletic and was never interested in sports, but now I have converted her. She is a Notre Dame sports junkie, and she's now a big Cubs fan too. You know, like, Dad, will you be home from work in time for the ball game tonight?
By the way, did you happen to watch the ESPN was Sunday night? I think it was the Braves against somebody, and they talked about National League teams that they fear in the playoffs. None of these guys even mentioned the Cubs.
The Cubs are an odd team, and I think they are who they are at this point. You know, we're not going to see it. So they run hot and cold as an offensive team, and when they're hot, they are really, really good. And it has been nice lately that Bregman has started to live up to that contract that he has and has been excellent. and PCA has been excellent, and Suzuki had been really solid all season long. Everybody else runs so hot and cold, and I've said this before on the air, they have a real knack for all going cold at the same time. You know, it's usually you sort of expect, well, this guy's in a slump, but everybody else is hitting okay. That's not the Cubs. When they want to go cold, they go cold together. And so that's, you know, that's part of their agenda. If you catch them when they're hot, they're going to beat you. If you catch them when they're cold, it's going to look pretty bad. But what their identity is that they're a great defensive team. Even with Dansby Swanson out, they're still an outstanding defensive team because, you know, Nico Horner's moved over to shortstop, and he's a Gold Glove caliber second baseman who came up as a shortstop, and he plays the position really, really well. And then Ramirez, who's moved in at second, has done a really nice job. They, you know, you could go around their defense and say Gold Glove caliber at third, Gold Glove caliber at short, Gold Glove caliber at second, maybe borderline Gold Glove caliber at first. Gold Glove left field, Gold Glove center field, right field, okay, you know, not great, not bad. And, you know, that's, as a pitcher, that has clearly been the case for people like Peterson, who came over from the Mets, who had a terrible defense, and all of a sudden he's pitching really, really well for the Cubs because he's a ground ball pitcher and nothing's getting past the Cubs defense. So, you know, that's really how they're going to win games, is by keeping the score down, playing great defense. That's their identity. I don't know how deep that'll go in the playoffs, but it is who they are, and I think, you know, they have some contracts coming up, so they will have a chance to reshape how the team is. I think they have to become a little bit more consistent top to bottom on offense.
Well, somehow or another, they...
It may cost them a little bit of defense. They may have to give up a little defense to do that.
There's some kind of issue. I mean, I don't know the stats, but when you watch them, if the pitchers can do what they want to do, meaning nobody on base, they seem some nights are very feeble. Actually, I think, Kevin, you look at the stats, you know, you and I are always talking about stats, you can do whatever you want with them. They actually, in terms of runs per game, is a mean, they're one of the best teams in baseball. They're like third. But it seems to me that they either, it's kind of like feast or famine. If they have people that get on base and they're doing okay, or the other pitcher walks a couple people, all of a sudden, and they get a bunch, they all get fastballs more than you normally get. All of a sudden, they're absolutely barn burners, where they're going to be shut out two nights in a row and score 19 the next day. I mean, I think if you look at their median score, I bet they're nowhere near one of the best teams in baseball. I mean, I'm just lobbing that one out there because you're more into stat stuff than me, but it seems...
Yeah, look at it like this. When you look at average, it doesn't tell you much. It tells you something, but it doesn't tell you much. It is really variance that matters. And it matters in all walks of life, and it matters a lot in sports. And variance just means, you know, what are you at your best versus what are you at your worst, and how far does it swing? I did an analysis of this because I teach a lot of quality management, which has a whole lot of standard deviation calculations and run control charts and all that kind of stuff. In fact, that's what I'll be teaching this afternoon. And so I went back, and this goes back a ways, but I still have the data. Notre Dame basketball had two players playing together, a guy named Matt Farrell, who was a guard, and a guy named Bonzi Colson.
I love Bonzi.
Yeah, Bonzi was terrific. So if you looked at Bonzi, he was about an 18 points a game average, 17, 18 points a game. And he would get 20, 21 sometimes. But, you know, you could pretty much put him down for 15 and then, you know, really expect him to get right around his average, which I think was about 17 and a half. And he didn't have these games where he only got 5, and he didn't have a lot of games where he went out and got 30 either. He was a really good player and a really tough player. I think he's still playing in Europe. And
plus, I love the name.
Yeah, and that was his given name. I heard someone ask him once if he had a nickname, and he said no. But my reaction to that would have been, I don't need a nickname. My name is Bonzi.
Andrew, what would life be like if your name was Bonzi instead of Andrew?
I think it could be better. I think I could work with that.
There you go. At
the same time, he had teammate Matt Farrell, who had roughly the same scoring average. But Farrell was the guy who could go off for 35 points, and he was also the guy who the next game could go and get, you know, 4 or 5 points. And he so his variance was much higher. Now, if you had to do an offensive game plan, you want a game plan for Bonzi Colson, because you know what you're going to get from him. You know what you can get. If you had a game plan for Matt Farrell, you had no idea what you were going to get the next game, and you can't plan around that.
No.
And I think you start thinking about that with the baseball lineup or anyone else. You know, you don't know if you're going to, you know, take Ian Happ as an example. When Ian Happ has a hot week, it's great. But when he's not having a hot week,
I don't think his hot weeks are random. That's my point of this, and I don't know how to.
Randomness is a part of variance. Randomness and non-randomness are part of variance. So, you know, that figures in there as well, you know, speaking statistically. So, you know, if they're not random, then you should be able to fix it. If it's random variance, what the hell do you do?
I don't think in baseball it's ever random. It's how many fastballs people get.
And that's non-random. So he's either got to learn to hit the fastball, hit the curve, hit the whatever.
Well, but a lot of people can
stop,
hit the curve.
Or stop chasing them. And actually, he's a pretty he's a very disciplined hitter. If you look at his on-base percentages compared to his batting average, he's, you know, he shows up as a disciplined hitter. I don't have a problem with with Ian Happ as an example, other than that when he runs cold, it really sucks. But he's outstanding outfielder, and it's not that he's, you know, plays bad baseball, that he doesn't have plate discipline, all those things that frustrate me about some players. It's just that sometimes he's just not very good.
Well, the one thing I have against Craig Counsell, because I think he's a spectacular manager, but I don't know what kind of hitter he was. He was a good shortstop. He was, you know, he's a middle. Better than middle of the road player, but to me, it's all about getting people to how many fastballs, because nobody can hit the ball in the dirt. I mean, it's that simple. I mean, the curveball drops 4 feet. So I seem to recall the 84 Cubs, of course, you know, it's a long time ago, or the 89 Cubs were sort of much more consistent. They could score in sort of different ways. But it didn't surprise me the other night, for instance, when Ian Happ, like you're talking about. The guy walked 3 people in a row. So up walk Ian Happ, and the guy comes in with a fastball, and he loses it for a grand slam. Well, you know, I can't hit a grand slam, so it's not like it's an easy thing to do. But it sort of doesn't surprise me, you know, that when they had to come into him. And that's what you try and do as a manager. And Craig Counsell seems sort of oblivious to that. I mean, he puts people all different parts of the lineup. And where they always had, when Bobby Dernier got on first base, his job was to mess around with the pitcher enough to where Sandberg got a fastball. Because Sandberg, what did Steve Stone say back then? The inside fastball is going to put Ryan Sandberg in the Hall of Fame. In the years where he didn't have Bobby Dernier and didn't have Jerome Walton in front of him, he was still a very good ball player. But when he had those guys in front of him on base, all of a sudden he was Baby Ruth. You know, and it makes a, and I don't, I think Counsell sometimes is sort of oblivious to that, to where, you know, there's that 84 team, it seemed like they had that, they had home run. Every night they scored, certainly in September, because I was going to all the games, I had all the tickets. 4 runs, 5 runs, every night. They're winning 5-2, 6-1. Once in a while they'd lose 8-6. But they were very consistent. And I don't know if they averaged any more runs than this team, but it sure seemed different. These guys.
I don't know that I agree that he is oblivious to it. And I say that because,
that's a harsh statement, but I'm saying, well, I mean, he had Pete Crow Armstrong batting ninth for a while, and he's your fastest guy. You know,
right? But they also totally understand that against right-handed or batting right-handed, that Happ has been way different from Happ as a left-handed hitter.
Yep.
And since they acquired Tyrone Taylor. To play the outfield, Taylor's been playing a lot of left field against left-handed pitchers, and Happ has sat down. But the other thing is, I think there's a big part of counsel that understands what his team's strength is, and he doesn't want to give that away. So he understands that defense is what they do best, and so defense is what's going to play for them.
Well, to me, Nico Hoerner is an absolutely perfect second batter. And some nights he bats the guy seventh. And what's he doing down there? I mean, he's the one he can handle the ball. If the first guy, you know, hits a double, he's going to hit to the right side. None of the other people have a clue how to do that. I mean, these are all skill sets that kind of belong in certain spots in the order, I think. But maybe that's just me.
Well, that's a pretty traditional outlook, and it may, you know, I'm not going to really argue with about it because I like Nico Hoerner in the two hole a lot. But I'll also look and say, you know, Nico Hoerner, you know, he gets on base, but not, you know, he's last year he was, you know, .345 on base, very disciplined. Was getting on base a lot, and he's a fast runner, so he gets to score. This year he's .318, which is about, you know, league average. It's nothing special, and if you look at strikeouts, he already has at this point more the same number of strikeouts that he had last year.
Why do you think that is? Because he's improved every single year up to this year.
Yeah,
you think some of these guys have nagging injuries that just nobody knows about?
It could be part of it. You know, that wouldn't surprise me, but it also wouldn't surprise me to learn that you know, that he's going to come back. That, you know, that all of a sudden we're going to see a surge at the end. Because over a sample size as large as 162 games, there is a tendency for guys to get all the way back to whatever their typical numbers are or close to it.
Kevin, you played more hardball than I did, but you know what seems to me strange, and this is probably maybe has to do, well, people always kept stats, so it's just easier to keep stats now. You know what it seems like they're doing to him when he hits the ball hard, which he does kind of a lot, he's really hitting it right at people. It seems like they know right if he's going to hit one, it's going to go straight to left field or it's going to go to right center. They're playing him. What can you do as a batter? I mean, softball, obviously you can deal with that if you have any kind of bat control. But in hardball, how do you do that? How do you? I mean, one of the guys last week was saying that in terms of, you know, hard hit balls or something, his batting average is ridiculously low. I mean, wherever he hits it, there's a guy there. I mean, In hardball, how do you become that predictable when it's so hard to hit the damn thing?
But you do, and the other team knows it, and they position accordingly. And remember, they aren't allowed to fully shift anymore.
I'm talking in the outfield. I mean, he's hitting the ball, he hits hard to the outfield.
The outfield. They're well positioned. They all have the hit charts. And, you know, how do you counter that? I'm just thinking all you have to do is just go up and hit the ball hard.
Well, that's, you know, what he's doing, and there's always somebody there. That's the problem.
Because we've seen it with Suzuki.
Yeah.
You know, where, you know, he's having as good a year as he ever has. But last year he was, you know, a 245 and 326 on base hitter. This year he's 271 and 363. And I think that's another thing you see with Council is he's looking to get his highest on base percentages up at the top of the order. You know, he wants guys who are on base. He wants them bunched together as much as he can because he knows he's going to have some guys who run cold, and so he better get all his best hitters in the same place so that they can try to bunch runs that way.
Well, I don't, you know, the weird part is as a softball pitcher for years, it's not the same thing, I get it, but I'm a little, you know, weirded out on this on base percentage thing, because for Babe Ruth and Frank Thomas, yes, but I'll tell you what, I didn't walk anybody if I didn't think they could hit. I mean, if you're no threat, who the hell's going to walk you other than by chance? This idea that, oh, the guy only hits 150 but he walks 200, how does that happen? Why would anybody, if the guy can't hit the damn ball, why would you give him anything other than just throw it at him?
Well, you know, or you could look at, you know, a Kyle Schwarber, where, you know, for a long time was either a walk or a home run. But look, first of all, I don't care how you get on base. I don't care if it's a single or a walk. The other thing is the way pitchers are today, you know, we have a couple of things that are, and one that's going to affect batting average is that nobody is expected to pitch a complete game, that everything's a specialist, all you're getting is max effort. That is going to favor pitching over hitting, and, you know, so hitting is going to diminish necessarily. But there's also, you know, part of the analysis that they do is they understand that you can throw too many pitches in the strike zone. That if you can get ahead of a hitter, you want to get people to chase. You want people to swing at stuff that is, you know, not way off. You have to throw a competitive pitch. It has to look like it's a strike for a long time. But they've done this with Imanaga. They've said last year you were throwing way too many pitches in the strike zone. This year we need you to throw more out of the strike zone, get chases on it. But you have to be ahead of the hitters and get them anxious and get them, you know, willing to chase your pitch. And, you know, that's now part of the art of pitching that at once upon a time it wasn't considered that. You don't want to throw anything out of the strike zone.
I know full well about pitching one right down the middle, Kevin. Usually you had a duck.
Yeah, I know, especially if you were throwing into me.
Yeah, well, It shouldn't be a surprise.
So we got to wrap up, and I got to turn you over to John.
The only guy that I don't get to watch all the other people and all the other teams. I always thought that 1 year or 2 years, I never saw anybody quite like Jake Arrieta, because he would aim the ball right down the middle, and the late movement, depending on how he held the ball, he had the ball dance to the side late. And the batters could not fathom it. I don't see how I could possibly fathom. The other guys, like you're saying, you want the curveball to just snip the corner. You want the fastball to be just where you want it. He was like Greg Maddux, where Greg Maddux just kind of threw it down the middle and then had it move from the middle out.
Yeah, I don't think Maddux did that much. I think Maddux was pinpoint.
Well, but I'm saying he had that absolute pinpoint control, but yeah, it looked like it was going to be right down the middle, and then it wasn't.
Yeah, he had movement, but he knew exactly where it was going. Yeah, I think right now, and you'll hear people comment on this during the games, is that looked like a strike almost all the way in, and then it drove. That's what you want to do, and that's effective pitching, and it's pitching, you know, it's being effective out of the strike zone.
Well, so, one last question before we pile into Giant.
One and the guy takes it, now you're down in the count. So, it becomes, the art, Steve Stone likes to say the most important thing you can do is throw strike one.
One thing, I mean, he was mentioning, he said, what do you think the change is going to be? I was watching the Sox the other night, in terms of people's dealing with the pitch where you can appeal the pitch.
Yeah.
He goes, every team is going to tell every one of their players, do not take the second appeal until it's the eighth inning. The idea of blowing them both early.
To me, the instruction works like this. When does it really matter?
Yeah.
So if you have a close pitch on strike one, leave it alone. It's only strike one. You can still see a lot of pitches. So typically I would say leave that alone, unless it's so obvious that you just know you're going to get it. You want to hold it until it really matters, because you only get two. My other observation is that there are a lot of catchers, Carson Kelly, for example, who are very good at choosing when to appeal and when not to. He's got a really good feel for it. On the other hand, I think the hitters, they really suck at it.
Oh, yeah.
They all think that everything's a ball going to them, and they are wrong. A really high percentage.
Well, I know you're gonna disagree with me in this. Then we'll go to Jen. You're gonna disagree with me on this. We'll talk about it Friday. I think the rule has, I guess, always been the same, Kevin, regarding what piece of the ball has to touch one piece of the strike zone. But the idea that one little millimeter of the ball touches one little millimeter of the strike zone as being a strike, I think that has effectively increased the size of the strike zone.
Greg Maddux and Tom Glavin increased the strike zone.
Well, but I've seen some of these replays where a ball went by the guy, and the batter you know, appeals it, and I'm going, no friggin' way was that thing a strike. And you'll see, like, a millimeter of the ball touch the upper right-hand corner of the strike zone, and I'm going, I don't know. If it's not a ball, it sure should have been, because nobody could hit it.
It's no different than kicking up chalk on the baseline when most of the ball is on the foul side of it. It's the same thing. And if you appeal and you're right on that, call that a lucky guess more than anything else.
Right. I think it's effectively giving everybody another inch in the strike zone, because nobody would have really bitched about one where was that where 9/10 of the ball was out of the zone. Now it's a strike if you get it on appeal.
It is, and they don't appeal them all. So, anyway,
hey, by the way, I did listen to those.
I got a book.
Or I did listen to those movies you sent me. The 4.0, or I went to Industry 4.0.
Oh, yeah, 5.0. Industry 4.0, Industry 5.0. Yeah, it's pretty interesting, isn't it?
Well, you know, it's really the exact same thing Pullman used to do by hand, just a lot easier.
Yeah, it's the evolution. And this goes back to, you know, when we first started to be able to use steam to power factories. So, you know, Industry 1, all of those are industrial revolutions, and we're going from 4 to 5 real quickly. So it's like the life cycle of 4 has a short life, and then it's moving on to what's next.
Yep.
Anyway, okay.
All right, bud. Talk at you Friday.
Good morning, John. Goodbye, John.
Morning, Kevin. Have a good one.
Mr. Flanagan, how are you? We should have Dr. Johnson piling in at some point. He's not already here. So how are you?
I'm doing okay, Tom. How about you?
All right. Just, you know, fighting with Kevin about the Canada deal.
That's great. That's good radio, Tom.
Well, you know, I don't, everybody has their own negotiating style, right? And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I'm just from the, you know, one of the guys I've always liked was this Ron Ensign, and I listened to him yesterday, and he goes. I covered the 1 6 years ago. Andrew, did you send Dr. Johnson an invite?
I will get him one there.
Yeah, that's him calling, I think.
Gotcha.
We're gonna come send you right now. Send him right now. You think psychologists are somewhat? Give me talk to Andrew for a second. Hello. It's not my style to insult people while you're negotiating with them, and some people here have, I guess, figured out that that's okay for them. Let's put it this way. They've made peace with it. You know, the insulting New York style. You can't assume other people have, John. You just can't. I mean, Kevin seems to think that you know, that's just a negotiating ploy. But I don't want to be insulted before I go into a meeting. Do you? Maybe I'm too self-centered.
Well, yeah, maybe you know, Trump felt a need, you know, to be harder with Canada and you know, China too, were the ones who retaliated against the U.S. The other countries didn't, and we've done deals with all of them, Tom, with no kerfuffle or no dragged out. He said, she said, whatever. I've been following what the pundits are saying, and
we're sending you a Zoom right now. Yeah. All right.
The Canadian pundits are none too happy with Carney about this.
Because
Canada did nothing for like 12 months, Tom. They didn't come to meetings. They didn't do anything. They had no interest in getting a deal here. But they had this deadline the whole time. And then everything cooks up the last couple weeks, and they want a deal, and they thought they had a deal. And to listen to Jason Greer's explanation, which is a lot more information than Carney gave in his press release, I got to believe that a lot of Canadians feel really cheated by Carney here. It's brinksmanship of the worst kind.
I listened to three people that I thought were pretty good, and I listened to like a bunch more that I, got bits and pieces of. And the first one that really boggles my mind is the Ron Ensign. He goes, I covered this 6 years ago when Trump said we had this horrible deal with Canada, and he blustered all over the damn place, and how the NAFTA agreement was the worst thing ever. And he went
through. He was right about that.
Okay, well, no, you, you listen to him.
You're
about
saying
it.
He's right about
it. Well, you, you listen to him about it. So, I mean, whatever.
I'm saying he's right about it.
Okay, but his point is that
A lot of the people in Clinton's cabinet said this would happen.
Okay.
And everybody said, oh, you know, we'll worry about that when it happens. And it happened.
Well, the point being is, he goes, and he was quoting Trump, he goes, that this is, do we have Dr. Johnson?
Yes, you do.
Hey, how are you, bud? We're going through this candidate. Let us finish this candidate thing for a second, then I want to switch to talking about psychological stuff, and you can shrink Mr. Flanagan right in front of me.
I can tell you where the Pony League came from, but that'll wait.
All right. But the his point was, and he's quoting Trump, this is the greatest deal ever. This is 6 years ago. He goes, I have no idea why it all had to be reopened again. He goes, there doesn't seem to have been a cause. And he started the whole thing with the 51st state. So he did everything to piss everybody off on the other side as best he could.
I think China is the difference, Tom.
But I mean, you're searching for a reason for our guys to be right. And Santa goes, I don't know why this it's never been explained to me exactly.
Tom, if there were other information coming out of Canada that looked right to me, I'd give it its due. It hasn't come. I don't think they're... If they have it, why would they hold on?
The only thing that I think is different is when the bluster started when he came into the second term. Carney absolutely admits we've done everything we possibly can because we don't think we can count on America anymore with this guy in office. And from their side, I can see...
He's a tool of the WEF.
Okay. Come on. Everybody's a tool except Trump.
No, I'm saying... Carney is a tool of WEF. You show me why, that's a preposterous thing.
So you don't think that with Trump in office, if you were the Canadian Prime Minister, you wouldn't try and find other places to sell your stuff?
If it weren't Carney, it would be a very different ballgame. That's all I'm saying.
Okay, but
if it weren't Carney's style, it would be a very different ballgame.
Well,
but Carney's got a whole different set of fish to fry than what Trump does.
Well, the point remains the same from Ron and Senna. Why now? We got a war going on. We have a guy who said the last deal was the best thing ever, and now all of a sudden we precede this by 51st state and this, that, and the other thing, and we're going to do all these things, and then we start the negotiations, and something happened between Thursday and Saturday, and I've listened to like three or four different people say what, and a couple guys seem to zero in on the approval of other deals they have. And again, these are just a couple guys. And one guy said the assumption was that the tariffs going down on automobiles was all vehicles, and at the last minute, the U.S. said, no, that doesn't count for medium vehicles and heavy-duty vehicles, and that was a deal-breaker. Now, who the hell knows if it was or wasn't? But
I think it had to do with Chinese content in the cars assembled in Canada.
What do they make up there other than Fords and Chevys?
Well, if they make them with Chinese steel, we have a problem with that.
It's a Ford.
But if it's made it with Chinese content, Tom, this is why we have tariffs.
Okay. I mean, I don't know how much of that kind of steel comes over here from those guys.
We don't want any of it, and I think we're entitled to feel it.
Okay. We don't want any of it.
We don't want any of the Chinese steel in the cars we take from Canada. Why? That's a reasonable position.
Why? We have Chinese stuff all over the damn place.
We don't want Canada being a satellite state of China.
I don't think anybody's more a satellite state than China than we still are. But that's another. So, Dr. Johnson,
more reason why we don't want Canada to be like.
Oh, we don't want them to be like us. Dr. Johnson, what do you make all this?
I'm out of my depth here because I don't the vagaries of tariffs and the back and forth in international trade is not my long suit. So I'll stay on the sidelines. I'm a naive citizen saying I wish we would get along better with our neighbors economically as well as politically. So that's all I know.
Did you ever, in fact, your state was one of the ones
they want to send us out because we're way too blue for the current administration.
Well, when this was happening 6 years ago, it's one of the reasons why I'm pissed off about it. I don't want to have to do this again. I actually went through, Janet, were you on? Somebody was on. I actually opened up like the tariff thing with Canada.
Right.
And it's hundreds and some pages long. It's about the finest print you'll ever find.
Mm-hmm.
And it's cottage cheese, whole milk, small curd, large curd,
maple 2% syrup.
Maple. The thing, he's sitting there, and every one of these lines must mean something to somebody. You know, who the hell's all, whose fingers are all over this stuff? It's the most complicated damn thing on earth. And I was hoping I wouldn't have to do that ever again, is to go through some of this crap. And it just, I mean, I was kind of arguing with Kevin. I go, when they said we're having a tariff on Canadian automobiles. Now, you know, Jan, you know, essentially jumps to the defense and says, okay, there must be a Chinese hood on there we're pissed about. Canada doesn't make a car. There's no Canada Canuck car that comes in here. It's not like putting a tariff on, you know, a Volkswagen 30 years ago where it showed up on the dock and there it was. I mean, these parts go back and forth. So I'm trying to get to the detail. You know, Mark, you've known me forever. Somehow or another, I dig into the detail and I always get confused. Let me get this straight. An engine and a transmission of the Chevy made in Ohio or some damn place is going to go to Toronto to be assembled into the final Silverado. Now, they're going to charge a 50% tariff, what, on the engine and the transmission. And then when the thing's done, it comes over here, we're going to put a 50% tariff on the final price. I mean, where is the detail in this? So the truck is now $300,000. I mean, what are we talking about? Does anybody even know?
I mean, there's all kinds of, you know, I'm sort of a car wonk, and it's, you know, you might want to buy American, but you're going to get parts from all over the world.
Yeah.
And it may have been assembled in Mexico, or your Hyundai may have been made in Indiana, whatever. Right. It's a globalization argument, and I don't know. I would think it would. Psychologically, it would argue for cooperation rather than this kind of competition. Does it add value to a customer to tariff? I don't know
it's
that
a, it's
answer.
A tax.
That's a question for you guys.
It's a tax. It's nothing but but you know the.
And who's paying it, and to whom?
Well, we're paying it. The guy who gets the car buys
right.
the car.
So what does that get us?
Well, I mean, John, you mentioned the Chinese part of it when Audrey's cousin was still alive. He's unfortunately passed young. He was in the car business, knew everything about cars. I'd be talking to him, and he goes, you know, in the new cars now, there's something like, what the hell did he tell me, 20 different little computer chips?
There's more than 20.
But, yeah, but how many different motors there are? Like your
sensors
your,
and
yeah,
modules
like
your, and computer your, boards.
Your seat has, you know, something like 6 different motors on it if you got a power seat.
Right.
Because all that stuff is made in China, or somewhere over there. That we don't make those little motors. We don't make the little, you know, this kind of resistor that goes in here. He goes, an old car didn't have any of this stuff. He said, but the new car, they're all over the place. You know, when your seat remembers whether it's your ass in there or your wife's ass in there, that's a computer chip. You know, and every sensor, but all the little motors, we don't make that stuff here. We never did. He goes, you know, that's to try and get parts for this stuff. That's why when you get rear-ended in your new Lexus and you have the backup camera and the, you know, the sensor for the tires and the sensor for the alignment, it's not the metal putting back together. It's getting all that stuff back together. It takes the body shop 3 weeks. You know, it's a whole different world. And all that stuff, I don't think we make that here, do we? I doubt it.
No, I mean, like Taiwan's involved. There's other makers, but we need all that kind of stuff. Yeah, although it pales in comparison to what happens if you get hit in the rear end of your Rivian.
Oh yeah. Oh God.
Bankrupt your insurance company.
Well, you hear stories. What Kenny Pulcheri, John? What did he say? His wife got rear-ended in the Lexus, and he said it didn't even look that bad. It was $25,000, and the insurance company didn't total the car. They said, no, the car's worth 60. Pay for it. What the hell? What's the last time you bought a car for $25,000, let alone a repair bill?
When would I have ever had the money to buy a car for $25,000?
Well, John, you just bought a new car. Would you pay $80,000?
I leased it.
You leased it.
And it wasn't $80,000.
I mean, you just...
It was in the 20s.
So. I mean, we have... I argue with people back and forth all the time here, but I zero in on the problems that we have in this country and the $40 trillion we owe people. And some of the stuff, I mean, you know, you can argue about the administration, people like them or don't like them, but just the stuff I see, and Kevin's right, I don't dig through a lot of the stuff he sends me like I should, because he's very dutiful for doing it. But I just look at this week, and Mark, you know I've always been a number guy. We've got our Secretary of the Treasury. Last week, the news everywhere was we just blew through $40 trillion in debt.
Right.
And then all of a sudden this week, the buffoon, or maybe he's not a buffoon, comes out and says, oh, don't worry, I got $1 trillion in my, essentially in my piggy bank. And I'm like, wait a minute. where did that come? I mean, it's like me having $100,000 in credit card debt and telling you two guys, hey, I got $1,000 in my pocket, let's go out and have a steak dinner. I mean, what are you talking about? how can you have a trillion for your own use when we're $40 trillion in the hole? Where'd that go? Why shouldn't we be?
You guys are the business and math guys and economists. That's a question. You know, Bob, back in the day, Tom, Bob Golden, our dearly departed friend, many years ago would say the big problem here is the debt. Right. Bob was an accountant and a CPA and a lawyer, and he had, you know, had a sensibility about that. But I, as an ignorant citizen, it's like, what? It's hard to understand what the debt means when we just keep piling it on and it looks like business as usual. How is it not business as usual?
Well, it's one thing's for sure, and I think maybe Mr. Flanagan might agree, is who's ever in office right now, these guys don't care about the debt until maybe after the election. In a minute, you know, and everybody's been like that, from Bush 1 blaming Greenspan for not pouring money in the system when he was running against Clinton, right? So, I mean, there's no way they care about the debt between now and November.
But what are the consequences of the debt for real?
Well,
how does it affect us?
Well, that's sort of an interesting question. And it's very, Mr. Flanagan, pile in if you want. But the deal we sort of have with the rest of the world until, and I'll say this flat out, Trump either doesn't understand it or doesn't care about it. The deal has been, when you talk about these trade deficits and so forth, they're trade deficits. But they're not, when you have floating exchange rates, there's something called the current account deficit. So all should match up. Okay, or else the pound would go flying one way or the other. So let's say we import a bunch more stuff from Britain than they do from us, just as an example. Now, it's complicated because individual people there are doing, but basically, we buy whatever it is, you know, rugby balls from Britain, and all that money's over there. Well, those countries that we have this big trade deficit with, like Japan and some of these places, they turn around and have been buying our debt, which allows us over a period of time to essentially always be beyond our means. I mean,
by buying our debt, you mean like buying U.S. savings bonds or something else?
Yeah, basically, well, treasury debt.
Okay.
A trillion one of the debt the government owes is to Japan. And it's like $980 billion to the U.K. So when you say we're going to stop all this trade imbalance with Japan, wait a minute. The flip side of that is, who's going to show up at the next auction? You know, this becomes very complicated because like 40% of our debt is now overseas, or 45%. So just because we have a trade imbalance with Mexico, like a simple example is if Mark Johnson and John Flanagan put up a car plant in Mexico and we bring in cars, well, there's going to be a trade deficit, right? But if the plant turns around and sends the money back to you two guys in a check, there's a net zero. Because we spent the money for the cars, but then you sent the money back as profit to you two guys. So that's the current account deficit. I don't know that Trump understands that necessarily. He thinks that any trade deficit is a bad one. Well, you know, pick a simple... Mark, you know, from my I always look at the world from the bottom up. I mean, instead of looking at the big numbers and making my decisions, I say, okay, how does that affect Mark Johnson, John Flanagan, or my clients? If they're going to the store and they're paying more, all that adds up to the big number. A lot of people just like talking about the big number, but just take the simplest case. We all like cocoa, all right? Everything in this country wants, you know, chocolate sundae. Well, there's one island someplace that's the only place you can get cocoa. So we buy cocoa from them. So they got a bunch of dollars over there. Are we screwing them necessarily? We got a trade deficit. I mean, Trump would say yes, or seems like he would say yes. Now, wait a minute. Now, what are they going to do with the dollars? Well, they could turn around, come back here and you know, and buy a few cars with it. Or they might buy wine from France. Now, France has got the dollars, and they got the wine, and we got the cocoa. Now, what's France going to do with it? Maybe they'll buy something. But the fact is, someday it makes its way around back around here, either to buy something or to buy bonds or to buy stock, right? So that's the current account deficit. We don't talk about that. We just say that the cocoa place, they're screwing us. No, they're not. They're selling us cocoa that we want, right? I mean, it's okay. Nobody ever really explains how this all works because it gets very complicated. But somehow or another, if all we did was buy stuff from other people, and none of the money ever came back here, the British pound would be worth $4 instead of $1.16, right? But it gets back here. How could it not?
I mean, on a David, I don't know if it's maybe it's an unanswerable question, Tom, because of the complexity. But I think on a David, it just seems, you know, naive to me in my own naivete. It's like, okay, would we be better off if there was like, could we if we retired the national debt?
How you do that?
Yeah, well, how is it an impossible answer for me too? But what I mean, there's where the what difference question comes in, because every administration bumps into the we have to raise the national debt ceiling, and they do, right? That's what's happened in our lifetime. So the debt just keeps growing. But it seems like this is me not being an economist. It would seem like eventually that has to devalue the dollar.
Well, it does. So that's why when you put money, and then what you do is you put money in the system to pay for it. The big, and Mr. Flanagan,
but you're printing money.
Right, well, yeah. For you to, I mean, cities and states can't do this. But if the three of us, can you imagine the three of us running someplace?
Might work out well.
It might work. But I mean, if John Flanagan comes into the Oval Office and the two of us are sitting there having a beer, and he goes, you know, it looks to me like next year we're going to spend $1 billion more than this year. And you and I look at each other and go, that's not so hot. Well, the next question is, where are we going to get the $1 billion? All right. We can do one of three ways if you're a government, not if you're the city of Chicago. Well, we can tax it. We can't do that. You know, we don't want to do that. That would be number one. Number two is we can borrow it, which is what we're doing a lot. Or guess what? We can print it, which has its own problems, because now if you pour more money in the system, your inflation goes up, and eventually people get pissed off even though there's nothing they can do about it. But those are the three ways. There are no other ways.
Well, another way would be you can find it if you've got, you know, hemorrhages going out the back and front doors because of fraud. Or
well, I mean, you could cut spending, but let's assume that when you come in with the number, say, I need another $1 billion next year, let's assume you've already done that. I mean, we could turn around and say, John, cut $1 billion somewhere and come back with me with a zero number, but that's not what's happening, right? And you compound it by saying, and this is Trump's first tax cut, and then the great big beautiful bill. The insanity was, if we cut taxes, it's going to make people so much more productive, we're going to essentially end up with more at the end of the day. Well, that's stone-cold ignorant. But also, Biden's, we're going to have all this infrastructure bill, and by the way, we're going to have 5G capability in Inglewood, and that's going to make everybody so productive that we're going to get more money in taxes. That was stone-cold ignorant as well. You know, so, I mean, we have this idea because, I guess to answer your question, Mark, there is a law in the books that every time they come up with one of these spending bills, somebody has to justify it as being actually accretive to revenue going forward, right, John? And that's where the lie comes in. I mean, nobody looks further out and says, boy, this Trump's tax cut bill isn't exactly doing it. A perfect example was, I think we might have been in school, Mark. Reagan came in with a big, huge tax cut, right? Which in some of it was justified, corporate rates and so forth. Well, the next year, the receipts were so horrible. The next year, Reagan put through the biggest tax increase in U.S. history up to that time. Everybody forgets that part.
I didn't know that.
But the thing of it is, the first time was a lowering tax on which corporations were paying 70%, so it was too high. Mm-hmm. But the second time, it was Social Security and everything else, John? So what did they? What was the name of that bill? But it was a year after the first tax cut took way more out of their out of the system than he. Even the Republicans panicked the next year, so we got to get more money in here. So
that was the mistaken belief that you could just starve the beast. If you curtail the revenue coming in, of course the government is going to be spending less because of that. There was no cuts in expenditures at all in that year. No wonder we had to have a huge tax increase to cover what we hadn't figured out was going to happen. But that was the stupid trickle down, bunch of
Don't act like the trickle down is gone.
No, but the idea that you could just cut off revenue and the government would adapt to that cut by being smart.
Well, that's not the same as a trickle down. Says you give money to the rich people and it trickles down to the poor people. That never happens. But you know, there's some people still believe that. Your buddy Ackman and Elon Musk, they think that, don't they? What's good for them is good for us. So, Mark, hey, tell us what's going on with the. We've been quoting you. Well, regarding you're saying you're doing some work, consulting work in New York, and I am. And actually, we had Dr. Eric May was on last week, and he's going to be on every other Wednesday. But he was talking about how we've kind of come full circle on education. John, you were on with him, and if I misspeak here, he said when he went to school, and Eric's about our age, he said the idea is that college was cheap, and you went to college to learn something, but mainly you went to learn how to learn and to sort of get along with people and all the other stuff that went with it. And nobody really cared like what your major was. Your parents didn't, as long as you got good. The idea was you were now a step up in terms of as life changed for you, you should be able to adapt because you learned how to learn. And he said, but then the price of college went up so much that it became, people looked at it as like a vocation school, where you either had to go for computer stuff, you had to go for engineering, you had to go for accounting. He said, now we're running into the problem there is you've got a lot of debt, and oh, by the way, which is exactly what you were talking about 2 weeks ago, he said, now we have people in like the IT area that never learn anything else other than IT with the promise that that was going to be a job for the rest of their life, and now in their 40s, they're getting laid off. And I go, God, did you listen to Dr. Mark? And he goes, now they have nowhere else to go. And oh, by the way, they might actually be living in a place that's real high price, and they can't afford even staying there looking for a job. And I'm going, did he listen to Mark? It's exactly what you were talking about. He goes, we've kind of come full circle. And part of it had to do with the cost and other stuff.
Well, I could be preaching to the choir here with John, because we're both liberal arts majors. I mean, the thought then was that it aided critical thinking skills, right? That you could, there was a transfer of training, if you will, to almost anywhere. You could be an English major and go to law school. Why not?
Yeah, but it's true. You went to psychology school.
Yeah, true. But I do, what you said a second ago, Tom, is you're seeing everywhere, which is kind of college as trade school, where it's like, kids pick a major because they're looking at where can I get a job, which is a pretty smart idea when you think you could be six figures in debt coming out of college. How do you pay for that? I mean, it looks like any of those though are short-sighted in the sense that there's things like AI happen, and all of a sudden the job you got trained for it is no longer, or you're going to become obsolete very shortly. And then where's the soft landing? Right, where are you going after that? Locally, we're seeing more and more really bright high school kids pick to go to the vocational high school here so they can become electricians and plumbers, right? And in a little state like this, that can work. I mean, eventually you're going to hear there's too many electricians because we don't need, we need more of them than we've got. But, any of those efforts, I think, suffer when we lose critical thinking skills. And that shows up all over. It shows up in parenting. It shows up in teaching. I mean, I get teachers in my practice chronically complaining now about their students don't think well. I mean, they don't write well, and they don't express themselves well. I mean, and they don't interact easily, right? They have, part of what the consulting in New York is about is just, I mean, we're calling it systems training and relating, and it's simply, how do you communicate with people face-to-face? And it's almost becoming quaint, right? Because so much communication is virtual, online, through a computer. So we try, we do Zoom stuff, but we really try to do this, at least start that training program face to face. And it's no big surprise. It really makes a difference to actually look people in the eye and talk to them, right? And have to listen to them and learn how to paraphrase and learn how to join somebody when you have a difference to get somewhere that looks cooperative. And it's this generation, I'm positively disposed in that regard. These, you know, 30 and 40 year olds are really keen on this, and they want to know this, and they're really fast studies. They learn well. I mean, it's not like the people don't have the ability to do this, but I think there's it's like where do you learn it? Where do you get it? I mean, it makes me think of simple stuff like the Air Force Academy actually had a program where they had to teach cadets how to talk to people at a formal dinner. I'm not making it up. Because these guys they sit down, they don't even know how to use a fork and knife, or they don't know how to speak to anyone or ask a question or just open up in a way where there's dialogue. They're kind of push button about it all, and then they get anxious. I mean, it's surprising how much social anxiety there is in that generation in terms of just straight up communication. So that's a long-winded answer.
By the way, I was at a big 1%er wedding Saturday night, and I think I used the wrong knife.
Again?
Back to school for you, sir.
I kept thinking about Belushi. Wrong glass, sir.
Lose the butter knife.
Just fill it up. You know, it's a... Yeah, I mean, I don't... We seem to... I mean, Kevin, I think if I were to go back to... If I was going to do any teaching, I'd like to do what Kevin's doing, where you have people that are, you know, essentially
motivated.
Adults.
Yeah.
And but even, you know, I took the, you know, economics at Notre Dame, which is in, there was two, there was business economics and there was arts and letters, and I took the arts and letters, but I wanted to be as, I mean, I took a whole year of accounting. I mean, you could do this at Notre Dame. You can't do it at something. I don't think if you go to computer engineering now, you can go to Illinois and sit in an accounting class for a year. I don't think they let you do that. But, I mean, I did accounting, I did finance, I did money and banking, I did tax. All while I was, you know, allegedly in arts and letters.
Yeah. I think that's smart.
But, I mean, Kevin talks that once in a while he'll see somebody in, you know, they'll be in supply chain management. They come in there making, you know, 18 bucks an hour and a couple certifications, and all of a sudden they're doing some supply work and they're making 35. And the guy or lady feels, hey, I'm moving up the ladder here. He goes, they might come and take an accounting course or finance course or marketing course because they think in their next job they're going to need it. But the price that they're charging where Kevin is okay. What do you do, you know, like Bill Moriarty, the late Bill Moriarty said that nobody wants to be a civil engineer. He goes, everybody wants to be a computer engineer because that's where the jobs are. He goes, but civil engineering not only is a hell of a lot of fun, there's not many people entering it. You're always going to need roads and bridges. If ever there's going to be a job for a lifetime, that's your job, not something specific to, what you're doing. You know, might be computing or whatever, although you would think there's always going to be computers. It's, you know, it's kind of a mindset, and I think, isn't that what you're really working with these people?
Well, it's a good observation. I mean, I was just thinking it sort of extends even into something like medicine, where, you know, the shortages are in primary care and psychiatry and pediatrics. Why? Because they pay the least, and so with the pressures, economic pressures of people coming out of med school with, you know, half a million in debt in some cases, unbelievably, they all want to be radiologic oncologists or anesthesiologists or surgeons because they can at least pay off their debt and maybe own a house. That doesn't serve the general populace, right? And there's arguments that there's enough doctors in the country, but they're not distributed well. I work with some of those people who did those studies. But it's economically right now, it becomes a real challenge.
That's total bullshit. Try and get an appointment.
Well, that's the point. I mean, for shortage areas, I ended up here because the Public Health Service funded my graduate school, and I did in my internship at Dartmouth, which was considered an underserved area. Okay, so here I am, 40 years later.
Well, I mean, I would say, you know, as you age, you not only maybe need a doctor once in a while, but you have a lot of friends that give you stories about them, and you're happy to listen because they're friends. But I hear stories about people waiting for a, you know, heart guy 5 months or something. I mean, it's unreal.
Yeah, no, there's specialty shortages are, you know, all over the place. And so, but I think that if you go back to the educational piece, I think we haven't done our young people a great service to not urge them to be, you know, we sort of had the benefit of being able to follow our noses at school and, you know, find what was interesting to us. I mean, I think that's what puts people in other places is something quaintly, you could call it passion, but like, what really excites you? What do you really want to do? That can fall on, you know, on the ground when what you might like to write poetry, but you're not going to make a living, right? You got to make a living, and economically, it feels like a very changing landscape. I'm just, you know, from watching it with these people, the map we have doesn't apply.
Well, I know I sound like a broken record, but cost enters into this dramatically. I mean, yeah. I mean, it's because, you know, what I do, I mean, you know, invest for people, and, you know, I'll have somebody will call and say, man, I think, you know, I'll kick it up here for a second, you know, because you've got to give an example, because everything comes down to some, you know, sort of cost. I'll use the layman's example. You know, a guy like Flanagan with all kinds of money, you know, he can walk into the Chevy dealership and look at the Corvette, and the guy will go, well, that's $100,000. The John will say, well, I don't have any problem with that. Well, how much is the insurance? Well, that's $10,000 a year. Why? What do I got to do, chain this thing to the curb? I can't even drive it. I mean, you know, what's it going to cost? He may say, all right, I'm out on the vet, not because of the price itself, but when you do, you know, option trading, to a certain extent stock trading, although people more, if they like the stock, they buy it at sort of any price, which is dangerous, you know, Will Robinson. But if you look at even like a, let's say, I'll pick one up here. I just happen to have it up on the screen, Microsoft. I mean, you might say, boy, you know, the stock, I think, is going to, you know, it's kind of high here. You know, you might say that. You might also say it's a bargain here. And but then I think it's going down. And I go, okay, well, when do you think it's going down? Well, I think it's going down like next week. All right, well, the stock's 488. The 485 puts are $2.40, and you got 2 days, you know, or something like that. And the guy goes, well, I'm not going to pay 240 for 2 days. I mean, Friday night, I got nothing. But if it right. was if it was 15 cents, somebody right. might say, well, I'll take a shot on that, you know, type of thing. So the price affects your decision more than you think. And I wonder that when we were in school, Notre Dame was $3,200 the last year. I mean, Eric said that he was a year ahead of us at Columbia, and he said he was $750 a semester. So, so count that $1,500 a year. And I think right. he lived at home, so he didn't need any room and board. But our room and board was only $1,000. I mean, we didn't have the world's greatest child, but we survived. Plus, we had pizza on the side. but I mean, what if in those days when our parents were making what they were making? What if the tuition would have been $20,000? Probably most of us wouldn't have been there.
I would have gone to a state school in New York.
Or the state schools would have been higher too. Or the question from mom would have been, okay, you better do something there where you come out here or you're gonna get a real job. Nobody gave me that question. Just graduate with good grades and maybe you go to grad school, maybe not, but we don't care.
And thinking too, and at least if you lived in Chicago where jobs were plentiful, I don't think my parents were particularly worried about whether I would ever work again. Of course I would. You know, I would do something. If it had nothing to do with college, it didn't bother them particularly, as long as I was happy and able to live on what I was earning. But what you were just talking about a little earlier, Mark, made me think. Remember how the disciplines, you know, that you could choose from in college were really, you know, straight-laced, hidebound, not much bleed between them. And, you know, that's so, I mean, the one counterexample I can think of, remember at Notre Dame, there was the general program?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Remember the great book series offered through that?
Yeah, and you get a degree in general program. And I remember reading about it before I started, you know, signing up for classes, you know, and I thought, gee, well, that's interesting. But I thought, I really want to dig into something. And I had always been interested in English and poetry and writing generally. I thought, I don't think I'm going to get enough out of general program, even though I'd like to know a lot of other stuff, to make me, you know, to satisfy my hunger for what I wanted to know about English. So that made it was an easy choice for me. But now I see in these, and this started in grad school programs first, I think, where there's this just bleed and, you know, merging together of all sorts of wild ideas about, you know, learning and history and everything else, so that you get a degree in justice studies at Northeastern Illinois University. Well, justice studies is what it's politics, it's political science, but it's also, you know, a dabbling of queer theory and, you know, African American history. I mean, all this stuff, and in service of, maybe it gives you some kind of literacy in a lot of stuff, but you're not really competent in any one field, and no wonder these people are ill prepared.
Well, John, why can't that person? Why can't that person take a year of accounting or marketing, like I did?
Well, absolutely, and they'd be better served if, you know, they were doing this in high school too. I have a feeling that the high school curriculum is just as debased, where there's an emphasis on things other than what students really need. Otherwise, I can't account for the horrible reading and math scores.
Well, Eric said the same way. He spoke, Mark, taught creative writing at Columbia, and he's written a couple of books and stuff. He goes, it's been the first 3 weeks on punctuation.
Oh, gotcha. Well, let me back. I love that comment, John. But let me ask you this. In your experience, you're an N of one, but we'll use you. How did your English background as a major prep you for law school?
Oh, it made it possible for me to read incredibly boring, dense material.
What do you mean? That's supposed to be scintillating, John.
Yeah, that was, but you know, and there was a lot of entertaining stuff I read as an English major too. But it really prepared me for just the volumes of horrible stuff, and to try to glean an idea out of it, and to appreciate the well written opinions or the well written case books. So that I could deal with the whole volume of garbage.
And I think it's a lovely example to me of where that. What started to show up in this in the 80s in the educational system, college educational systems, was a big pull for interdisciplinary studies, and you just cited that, right? So I would end up seeing some kid who was like double majoring in theology and physics. It's like okay, those kids were so much fun. Right, because they had a
theology and physics. I like that.
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, those kind of kids, they were 20, years old or so. But when I've seen Dartmouth kids like that, I mean, you could see the psych major. I'll pick on my own field, and all he wants to study is psych, and that's all he does. And then they get narrower. I was always impressed by the kids who got broader, and deeper.
I have an ancillary question. I probably shouldn't lob one in here, but my friend Bill Murphy is an attorney. He does a lot of criminal work. I mean, he's appreciably older than us, but he said the criminal code used to be 35 pages. And he goes, I knew every sentence in there. Because now the thing is huge, and I got to keep referring, and a lot of the stuff doesn't match up. A lot of it's conflicting. He goes,
ouch.
I mean, what's the difference now in law school than when you went? I mean, when you start, is the law even fathomable for people? He says it used to be, here was the criminal code. It made sense. You know, and you could look at it and you could know the whole criminal code. He goes, now you can't.
Well, and when there were changes, and there were big changes, those changes stuck around for a while. So when the bankruptcy code changed in 1979, a huge overhaul. That changed how, you know, bankruptcy law was taught. And, you know, that lasted for maybe a decade or two. Well, but everything now, the Illinois Criminal Code has hundreds of changes.
That's what he was saying, is you can't even...
Every year.
Yeah.
And never to simplify it, but just to make it more loopholes, you know, other thresholds, you know, descriptions of crimes not that weren't crimes last year, now they're crimes. All this stuff has, you know, I think it's easier maybe to research as a law student now than it was, because that was a totally different, you know, phenomenon. But I don't know if it's made for any more deeply read lawyers or lawyers who are really better equipped to deal with clients or tough situations. I don't know if the bigger picture here has kind of gotten lost in the smaller picture.
Kevin says both theology and physics are seeking the truth, Mark.
Yes, yes.
I think that's a good description thumbnail.
So what does that mean?
And they actually meet. I mean, you can theoretical physics and theology aren't that far apart.
So what does that mean to an economist? I'm nothing? You're not seeking the truth? You're seeking money? What are you doing?
Well, I'm not sure what you're seeking. That'd be a question for you.
God, I tell you what, seeking the truth in the world we have now is a tough one.
I just think there are so many majors now in areas of study where there's no respect for truth or no possibility of ever finding it.
You reminded me, one of my patients was a philosopher, and he when I was trying to get him to pay attention to facts, he corrected me by telling me that facts were the lowest form of the truth.
Don't ever let the facts get in the way of a good story.
And here you go. Don't confuse my father to my mother. Don't confuse me with facts.
If the queen had balls, she'd be king, right? I mean, so what are you, if there's no, I know you're trying to help some guys or in ladies. Uh-huh. What is, if you were in near Kevin's school, I suspect you might say, well, you know, find a couple of classes that you might help you out to make a shift. What do you do in New York when somebody's rent's $10,000 a month?
Well, yeah, that's a hard, good question. I mean, a lot of these, it's interesting because we're working right in Midtown. We get a lot of people from the theater and arts and that kind of stuff, and they have their worlds. Really different in the sense that they're it's like feast or famine. They're either between gigs or they're in the middle of a gig, and though there's kind of not much in between. But for the professional type, just the young up, you know, professionals, they're cobbling a lot. That's what it looks like to me, Tom. They're like, we grew up in an era where careerism was sort of a thing, right? You know, I can remember my father when I quit the medical school to go into private practice, he was nuts. It's like, you're giving up a pension to go work. It's like, you know, yeah, I am, because they're underpaying me. So what are you going to do? You went into a career. John ends up in it. We picked sort of career paths and could sort of stay there for a long time. This generation to me looks like they are very fluid around moving.
Yes, yes.
And they just go, they jump. I mean, I see this in my son-in-law. He's got a good job. He's an educational consultant, works remotely in D.C., and he's constantly applying for jobs because he's convinced that job, he's had it for like 8 years. You know, like any new shift in the wind here, I could be out of work.
Well, he's not wrong.
No, he's smart to do it, but it creates a kind of insecurity around both economics and job and locate all that stuff. I mean, it kind of makes shaky ground under this generation. And then, of course, the cost of housing and everything else is so. Now, I mean, you're right about New York. It's. I mean, you see these guys who have, you know, six-figure jobs and they're living in an apartment with four other people because that's the only thing they can afford.
One of my dash here pretty soon. But by the way, S&P futures down 11, NASDAQ futures down 120. So not much going on. We've got the NVIDIA earnings tonight, and everybody's waiting for those, so that's the big horse in the room. At dinner last Friday, actually a week ago Friday, with my godson, John Lee's son, and he went to Santa Clara. I don't know if he got a graduate degree or not. Really nice kid. But he's got a really nice job. He interned for this place. They love him, but he's moving from San Diego to San Francisco, and they're going to, and his, well, girlfriend, soon-to-be wife, and she's terrific. She's graduated in something medical tech of some kind, and she doesn't have a job yet, even though that's supposed to be the hottest field, right? Just what you're talking about, Mark. And so they're like panicked. I mean, he's doing well. I didn't ask how much he makes or anything, but whatever well means, but there's no way they're getting a place in San Francisco. They're going to go live with her parents for 3 months until she can get something, because there's no way he can carry an apartment, even with a really good job. Well, that's pretty scary.
Yeah, oh yeah.
I mean, it's totally. But by the way, they went to a wedding Friday night, and a lot of your old friends were there, and they all were asking about you guys.
Yeah, you were talking about that with Doc and his daughter, I guess.
Yeah, and Bill Hake was there, and Artie and Greg O'Leary and Craig Fowler. They all asked about you guys.
Well, good.
They're all
hello back.
Yeah, they're all doing good. It was a. I did run into a judge, and somehow or another, I got on the topic. He was the judge on the Board of Trade case. Jan, maybe we'll talk about this on Monday, because we don't have time now. But he was the judge on the Board of Trade case when the members sued the new Echelon as to they just got stock and then couldn't trade anymore. And I'll save his views to Monday. And it was a wedding. I didn't want to get into it with the guy, but plus it's a long time ago. I just said something about, he goes, well, you know, those guys were like, you know, I couldn't believe they're getting all this stock, and they're bitching about, you know, not being able to, you know, trade anymore. And I said, well, they couldn't. it was their livelihood, after all. I mean, and his point was,
get your attention.
Yeah, his point was, well, they got a bunch of stocks, they should just have been okay with it. And I go, I don't know if I agree with that, but I sure as hell didn't want to start a discussion at a wedding. But it's amazing how people think. You know, if I think it's enough for you, it should be enough for you. I mean, I don't know what they even call that psychologically, Mark. But you know, it's like if somebody thinks if a guy's got $1 million, he should be, you know, we should like tax him or do something because I don't have $1 million. You see a lot of that now because we're just stratified.
Back to my parents' time, one of my father's many one-liners was, "When I want your opinion, I'll give it to you."
Yeah. God. That's a good one. Hey, we have Eric is going to be on like every other Wednesday. So, Mark, if you want to maybe pencil yourself in like every other Wednesday, it would be terrific. And Mr. Flanagan's always the best. And Kevin, I love to fight with. I love to fight with. But it,
hey,
but
let me, Tom. I'm going to sneak in the Pony League if you got time.
Yeah,
it's two sides. So I only know this because Jamestown, where I grew up, had a Pony League team. The Pony League was an abbreviation for the Pennsylvania Ontario New York League. It was a short season Class A baseball, the lowest level of the minor leagues. It's probably closest now to what you'd see in the Cape Cod League.
Okay.
But we actually saw professionals come through, a couple of them. Don Clendenin, there's a name from the past.
Wow.
Pittsburgh. Jim Rooker, who pitched in the majors, played there. But,
Don Clendenin was a great player.
They were the point. Oh yeah, good first baseman for the Pirates
for like 15 years. He was a long time.
Yeah, then he played for the Mets.
I had no idea of any of that, Mark. Thanks.
Well, it's okay. So if I didn't grow up there, I mean, that's my first. I remember going to see the Jamestown then Tigers play with my grandfather, not a baseball fan. He went to this game in the middle of August with an overcoat and a hat, never took either one of them off.
Well, how close were you to Buffalo? Because about
70 miles.
Because most of the scenes in the natural were filled in Buffalo, right?
Well, the Bisons were, you know, a good AAA team, and I think, as far as I know, still are.
But even like the railroad siding part where he threw the pitches to the whammer and stuff, those are right outside of Buffalo, weren't they?
I didn't know that. I did not know that.
All right, guys. Well, 2 weeks, Mark, and Monday for
just
you,
give me, just shoot me a text or an email about the date, Tom, hold on to it.
I will do that. SP Futures down 10, NASDAQ Futures down 119. The day before the earnings, we've got NVIDIA down 58 cents, so not really giving us a clue here. We'll know tonight, and we'll talk about it tomorrow morning. Andrew, nice job with everybody coming in and out. By the way, Mark, you talked about guys in the theater group. That's what Andrew does, and it's next time you're on, he'll talk about what it's like trying to get jobs in improv and stuff like that. It's not easy. I mean, it definitely isn't. We'll be back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.